Good afternoon. So today we're going to continue talking about caches. I'm going to start by finishing up talking about rate policies, which we talked about how we generally design caches and what we think about when we're choosing between different cache parameters. And then I'm going to go into our next segment of the course, which is about how you can make code faster, starting by talking about how you can make your code be aware of what caches are doing. What choices do you have as a programmer to take advantage of caches? So last time we finished up by talking about our write policies, and one choice we had was that we could either, when the cache needs to write a value, either send that value immediately to memory, or we could decide we're just going to keep it in the cache. We're not going to spend the time to talk to the slow memory. But that means that when we actually want to get rid of a value from the cache, we're going to need to write the value later. So we have these two choices. The hope is that by not writing the value immediately, we can avoid writing it as many times as we would otherwise. And hopefully our cache is more efficient. But to do this, we needed to store some extra information, so there's an actual physical cost to doing this, that we need to keep track of what we call this dirty bit, which is the value in cache dirty, and do I need to clean it up before I get rid of it? And cleaning it up means sending it to memory. We also talked about a different choice that's related about what do we do if someone writes a value to our cache and we don't have a copy of that value. So the copy of the value is only in memory, and we have two choices. One thing we could do is we could just send the value onto memory and not do anything else. So that's the simplest solution. And this is called write, no allocate. We just send the value onto memory, don't do anything more. We assume that it's not worth doing any extra work in this case. Another option is called write allocate. Here, we want to store this value that was just written in our cache. We want to take advantage of what we think will be temporal locality that will be accessed again soon. This is going to have a cost because typically we're going to be rewriting 8 bytes, and our cache block is going to be something like 64 bytes. And we have no way of storing less than a whole cache block in our cache. So that means we're going to need to fetch the other 56 bytes in order to store this value in our cache. But assuming we actually have a locality, this is going to be worthwhile. So are there any questions about either of these write policies and how they work? Okay. So one thing which comes up when we talk about these write policies is that it seems like in either case, we're going to be spending this time where you try to write a value or you try to read a value, and that means we have to write a value, and we're going to have to wait for that slow memory to actually do the write. So it seems like that writes are going to be expensive no matter what. Either they're going to be expensive now, or they're going to be expensive later when we do a read which actually triggers a write of a dirty value. And real caches have this trick to avoid this problem, which is called a write buffer. So they have sort of a secondary backup storage for a few values that are currently being written to memory. So rather than waiting for the value to go to memory and be stored, they put the value in the write buffer and they start sending it to memory. But while the value is being sent to memory, the program can still run normally because the cache won't forget about the value that's being written. And this also means that if we read one of these values that we're currently writing, the cache can check the write buffer and make sure it gives you the value that's being written right now. So this is something that real caches implement, and this means that when we do that write back thing, where you read a value and that means we have to write something else, most of the time, the cost is just putting something in the write buffer. We don't actually have to wait for the memory to write the value and then read the new value. We can read the new value and then later on write it from the write buffer, as long as we don't run out of room in our write buffer, which, if you do enough writes, might happen. But typically won't. So we talked about lots of choices we make when we design caches. And There's a question of how do you look at all these options, and if I'm designing a chip, how do I choose what do my caches actually look like? And this is going to depend on the program. So one of the most important things about our caches is how often do we have hits? What is the miss rate? And this depends on our programs we run. So what people will do is they'll take some programs they think are representative. So for example, Spec publishes benchmarks. And the Spec CPU 2000 is a bunch of benchmarks. And you can run this in a simulator. So these are results where someone at the University of Wisconsin ran the Spec benchmarks in a simulator. And this simulator basically looked at each instruction one at a time. It looked at all the memory accessing instructions, all the load stores, and it simulated what would happen with lots and lots of different types of caches. So this means that it ran the programs really, really slowly when it was simulating them, because it had to simulate what would happen for 25 different types of caches. But this lets you figure out what would happen with all these different types of caches. So if you're designing a real processor, you're going to generate this sort of data, and you're going to use that to reason about, well, is it really worth going from eight-way to fully associative? And if you look at that decision, for example, you'll see, I can get 0.1% of the time I have where I wouldn't have misses before I would. Is that going to be worth the extra complexity? That's the decision you'll make. And you'll probably say, yeah, no. A fully associative cache is going to be a lot slower than an eight-way. And if it's only helping me with 0.1% of my memory accesses, probably not worth the cost. And you can see similar trade-offs for other things. So for example, when we increase our cache size for these programs, you can see that we get a lot less benefit when we go from 64K to 128K for these programs. That doesn't have to be true, but it happens to be true for these programs. And most programs have something we call a working set. There's some amount of data they're working on. And if you can fit that in the cache, you have nearly 100% hit rate. And if you can't, you have a much lower one. But after that, there's little benefit. And we're seeing that here, that most of these programs' data fits in 64K or so, maybe even 32K. And we have much less benefit from making our cache bigger after that. And if you care about designing caches, you look at this for programs you think are the type people will run on your processor. And you will figure out what cache sizes are actually going to give me a big bang for my buck. So this is about miss rate. So miss rate is the factor which varies between programs, because programs access memory in different ways. But to actually make a decision, we want to look at something like the performance. We want to know not how often do we have misses, but how fast will our program run. And typically what we do to do this is we try to think, how fast is it to access the cache on average? And there are several numbers that we'll talk about when doing this. So one of these is the hit time. How long does it take if I access the cache and the value's there? So this is the ideal case. So for example, in our pipeline processor, we have a one cycle memory. That's what it's supposed to do. So if that was a cache, that would be a hit time of one cycle. Otherwise, it would have to be slower than that. And hit time is going to depend on things like the size of the cache. Bigger caches are going to have a slower hit time. So we're also concerned about the miss rate. What portion of the time do we actually have a hit? And that, as I said, depends on the program. And when we have misses, there's some amount of time we're going to spend to actually fetch the value from the next level of cache and process it, put it in our cache, so we can return it to the processor. And that's known as the miss penalty. So this is the time to access the next level to get the value. This is something we only pay if we have a miss, because we're not going to access memory all the time just in case that memory can't handle that much. So we're going to try to see if the value's there. If it's not, we're going to pay the miss penalty. And sometimes you might see people refer to a miss time. The miss time is the hit time. So we check if we have a hit. And if we don't, we pay the miss penalty. And the sum of those times is the total time from when I request an address that isn't in the cache to when I get the value. Because when we're doing caching, we're going to make some accesses slower. And that's fine, because hopefully our miss rate is pretty high. Like you saw on this chart, or miss rate is pretty low, sorry, hit rate is pretty high. So you saw that our miss rates here are like, you know, less than 10% even for this dumbest cache. And that's pretty typical. And so from these, we compute a statistic sometimes called average memory access time. So this is, if I measure how long it takes for my data memory or instruction memory, depending on which cache I'm looking at, to give me a value back, this is the mean time that takes. And you can compute this saying, it's the hit time plus however often we don't have a hit times the miss penalty, the extra cost we spend on the miss. That's effectively how fast our memory appears. And this is typically what people think about optimizing when they're designing caches. And so as I said, this depends because of the miss rate. Because this miss rate really depends on what programs you're running, you know, you have to look at a program. You cannot reason about, is this cache better than another cache at all, unless you have specific programs in mind, because there will always be, you know, maybe the cache gives you a strictly lower miss rate, but that you're going to pay for that in hit time or miss penalty, or you pay for it somewhere. So we need to think about a program, and I can always, always make caches look horrible. So if you want to make a cache look really bad, you can construct an access pattern which makes it look really bad. The basic procedure, there's some detail that I might be omitting, is you access enough blocks to fill up the cache. So you just like access a bunch of sequential memory until all the blocks of the cache are filled. Then you access one additional thing you never accessed before, so that's a capacity miss. And that's going to probably replace something in the cache. Then you access that thing that was just replaced. Then you access, and then accessing that thing that was just replaced is going to replace something. Then you access the thing that was just replaced after that, and so on, over and over again. And this will give you an access pattern where if you made little teeny changes to the cache, you'd have a whole lot less misses. But every single access of the pattern misses. So you can do this no matter what the associativity is, no matter in the size. You can always do this sort of trick to make a cache look bad. So you can't say this cache is always better. You have to look at particular programs. And this makes sense because caches are about taking advantage of locality, which is a thing programs happen to do in practice, but there's no reason you have to write your programs to have locality. You can write a program where every instruction is executed exactly once, and you jump after every instruction, and you access different memory locations every time. Like, you probably wouldn't, because it's hard to imagine how you compute anything useful with that, but you could do that. Okay. But so keeping that in mind, I have listed what changing cache parameters typically does for each of these components of that formula. And so for miss rate, that depends on the program. So I'm saying usually increasing the cache size is going to make the miss rate better, but it's not guaranteed. It could have it be the same. But I'm telling you what typically happens. And for hit time, that depends on the hardware, so that's not going to be dependent on the programs. So you can see, for example, increasing the cache size typically makes the miss rate better, because there's more places to put stuff, but makes the hit time worse. So there's a question of how much are we improving the miss rate versus the hit time. That's the decision, that's what's going to guide the decision our processor designers make. They're going to look at that ratio and say, where is the sweet spot here? Similarly, associativity usually makes the miss rate better, not guaranteed. Probably makes the hit time worse because we have to check more tags in order to get an answer for do we have a hit and which block is the hit. Increasing the block size can make the miss rate better or worse. It makes the miss rate better because it means that the cache takes more advantage of spatial locality. if you leave the cache size the same, it makes it worse because you can store less distinct blocks in total, which means you have more conflicts. You have less places to put things, so you have more conflicts. So it depends on the program and what block size you're talking about, what effect it has. But it also makes the hit time worse because it takes longer to get a bigger block. And we have this fourth optimization here we haven't really talked about, of adding a secondary cache. So most of the caches we've seen in real processors, they have an L1 cache, usually a separate one for data and instructions. Then we have an L2 and an L3. And the way you can think of those second level caches is that we decided, oh, our miss penalty, it would be nice if we could make that smaller, and that secondary cache is how you do that. So the miss penalty is what you pay to go to the next level, so you make the next level faster by adding a cache there. And because we have this add a second level of cache option, there are an enormous number of parameters someone designing a processor has to choose from. So this is huge space, and typically, as I said, the way they're going to deal with it is they're going to try a whole lot of things, simulate a lot of them, figure out like how fast the hardware would be, and estimate what the performance would be on programs they care about, and use that to choose how they design their processor. So any questions about any of these optimizations and why I've given the particular direction I think things change, if they change? So, I have a little exercise here. So I've told you what a cache looks like with three parameters. So I've told you it has a 64-byte block size. It has 64 sets in total, so that's 64 rows. And each of those rows has 8 ways. So each set has 8 blocks of data. And I want to know which of these is likely to reduce the number of capacity misses. So remember, capacity misses are misses which we had because we just didn't have enough places, enough data we could store in the cache. There was just too much stuff we're accessing to possibly fit in the cache, no matter how clever we would be about where we put it. So even if we had a fully associative cache, it would still be a miss. But it's not the case that it was only accessed once. So which of these do you think, and there might be more than one, will reduce the number of capacity misses? And you're allowed to talk with the neighbor if you don't like giving me answers without checking first, which probably most of you. Anyone want to volunteer an answer? Yeah.
C.
C? So why C?
Because with A, or with the large size of blocks, you could be having a bunch of extra space that you don't actually need and aren't actually accessing that. So if you increase the number of ways and sets, then even though the blocks are smaller.
So are the blocks smaller, first of all? So this is something which comes up. When you're talking about changing a cache, you should try to read very closely. Because I could have made the blocks smaller to increase the number of ways of the set. But I said we leave the parameters listed above. And unfortunately, the size of the block, we left the same. So I'm saying that we're somehow increasing the number of ways per set. And so the natural thing you had in mind was, oh, that just means I have something that's this wide, I'm just going to add extra lines on it. But that's not what this is saying we're doing. So instead, we're taking the blocks we have and making 4 extra copies of them. So if we were doing what you said, yeah, you might have that. Then your idea is probably seems possibly correct. That's a borderline question. But in this case, it's clearer because we're quadrupling the number of ways per set. So we have 64 byte blocks times 32 blocks per set times 64 sets, which is going to be a much bigger cache. 4x size cache. So the cache is four times bigger when we do this, because I increase the number of ways by adding more blocks of the same size. And of course, that's going to have more capacity, so we'll have less capacity misses. And if we think about quadrupling the number of sets here, we have the same sort of issue. Like, one thing you might say is, oh, I'm quadrupling the number of sets. That means you're going to take our sets and make them thinner. But that's not what the question says. We're saying we're leaving the block size and the number of ways per set the same. So the sets are just as wide, have just as much data. We just have four times as many. So in each case, we have a four times bigger cache. So all of these are going to decrease capacity misses. This makes sense? So the issue here is that when I change any of these parameters, I change other things about the cache. So we often talk about cache size. I didn't specify the cache size. But changing any of these things can change the cache size. It's a question of how were all the values adjusted. And this is something which often confuses people. Because if I ask this question very slightly differently, so here, I didn't tell you the number of sets anymore. Here I had to say there's 64 sets. I didn't tell you the number of sets. I just said the cache is 64K. And I'm telling you to keep it 64K when you quadruple the number of ways per set and quadruple the block size. And that's not going to do the same thing for misses. So any questions about how different cache parameters change when we change one? Yeah. So if I, for example, just didn't tell you how many sets there were, you wouldn't, in this question, you wouldn't have enough information to know what happens. Because we could have quadrupled the number of ways per set by changing the block size or not. By changing the number of blocks in total in the cache or not, right? Changing the number of sets or not. Like, you wouldn't know. Which is why we have to give this something like when the parameters change. But it matters what things we're keeping constant. It's not obvious what is the most natural thing to keep constant. Like, it makes sense to say, yeah, I keep the size the same when I change the cache. It also makes sense to say I keep the number of sets the same. Because both are sort of natural changes you'd make if you were physically designing a cache. So any other questions about this? Okay. So that's our sort of abstract look at how caches work. And now I'm going to go into talking about caches and like actual performance. So here's some C code. So I can compute the sum of the even numbers, even index numbers from an array, and the odd index numbers from an array. And I have a 4 kilobyte array here. Let's say I run this with a 2 kilobyte direct map cache, and to keep things simple, let's assume all the data accesses are to array. We only care about the data cache, we don't care about instructions. And everything else is in registers. So we don't need to worry about cache misses accessing even sum. So given that, how many cache misses do I have? So figure this out, check with your neighbor. And to make this simpler, let's have an assumption here that this is at address 0. Just to make things a lot simpler. And you can compare with your neighbors, and please, you think you figured out a strategy for this. Anyone have an answer or part of an answer? So let's just do the beginning to give you an idea of how I'd like to start thinking about this. So in the first iteration of the loop, we access array 0 and array 1. So when we load array 0 into the cache, we're loading 16 bytes. And if it starts at address 0, the 16 bytes is address 0 through 15, because cache starts at multiples of the address, because we just take the top bits to determine the index, and the bottom bits to determine the offset. So we're going to load, in this case, array 0 through 3. Then we're going to access array 1, array 2, array 3. So we're going to have a miss and 3 hits. Then we're going to access array 4, which is not in the first 16 bytes. So that's going to be another miss, and that's going to repeat. So given that, how many misses should we expect to have? So our worst case would be we'd have 1,024. Because we'd access 1,024 things and they're all misses, but we determined that they're not, because when we access array 0, that loads a block that also holds array 1. So what's the total number of misses we should expect? Any, yeah. 256, so why 256? So 256, that's 1,024 divided by 4, which is the number of ints in a block. So we access 1,024 things, but there's 4 of them per block. And when we access one, we always immediately access all the other ones in the block. So that means that we have one miss for every block, which is another way of computing this, by the way. We could say this is also 4KB divided by 16 bytes. We have 4K in the cache. We access each block once as a miss and a couple more times as a hit. So we have that many misses, one miss for each block. Any questions about how I figured this out? Okay. So, here's a variation. So I've just written the code to compute the even sum in one loop and the odd sum in another, rather than having one loop for both of them. So now, how many misses do I have? So I'll give people some time to think about it. So things changed since the last time. So is this going to change the number of misses we have? So I'll give people a minute. So who thinks they have the answer? Just one, two, three, four. Okay. Would you mind? You mind sharing?
512.
512. So why 512?
Because we'll be still loading 4 bytes into the cache, except we won't be accessing like every other this memory address.
Okay. Yeah. So we're loading 16 bytes at a time. But each time we load 16 bytes, which is going to be, for example, in the first iteration of this loop, we load array 0 through 4. Well, 3 is the 0 to 3. But we only access 0 and 2. So we load 256 things for that first loop, and access 2 things each time, and then we load those 256 things again. So one question you have to figure out, which you didn't mention explicitly, but you probably reasoned about, is, well, when we load 0 through 3 here, when I equals 0, here we're going to access 1 and 3 in the second loop. So why don't we have a cache hit there? So what's the problem? So when I equals 0 in the first loop, we access array 0 and array 2. When I equals 0 in the second loop, we access array 1 and array 3. And we've determined that those are both in the first cache block of memory. So they'll be stored together in the cache. Why don't we have a cache hit? So why did you say 512 and not 256? Why do we have an extra cache miss in the second loop? Yeah. 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 So you're saying that it gets replaced by the first loop. And the reason we know that happens is that the total size of all the blocks we're accessing is too big to fit in the cache. We access 4 kilobytes worth of cache blocks in that first loop. And in fact, we end up replacing every single thing we accessed. The first thing we accessed is always replaced. And you can reason about this systematically by figuring out how things map to cache blocks. So the way things are put in cache blocks are the first address goes to set 0, first 16 bytes, the next 16 bytes go to set 1, all the way through all, in this case, 128 sets of the cache. And then we wrap around to the beginning. And since we have a 2 kilobyte cache, this means that if two addresses are separated by 2 kilobytes, they map to the same set. This makes sense? Good question. So since they wrap around like that, it turns out that if we look at what parts of the array go to which cache, they wrap around after array 511. So when we access array 512 for the first time in that first loop, that has to replace array 0 through array 3. So because we access array 512 before we access array 1 again, we don't get a cache hit that second time with the second version of those loops. And so this is capacity miss in this case, but we know it definitely happens because we can look at where exactly things map to the cache. And in fact, if we go through everything, we see that because we access the entire, all 1,024 entries of the array, all those blocks, we end up replacing every single thing we access in the first half of the array by the time we go through the first loop. So we actually have, no hits whatsoever. Okay, so what's that? So there's another question here. So, which is, would a subset associative cache be better? Anyone have an opinion on that? So, there's some reasoning, which is, well, two things map to the same set. So, would a set associative cache make that better? So, some people are shaking their head. Others are looking confused as fine. So the problem here, yeah.
I mean, you're gonna have the same tags, so you're just gonna overwrite the same thing anyway with the set associative.
Yeah, so with the set associative cache, we're gonna have more options, But oh, that's not right. So we're going to have more up. We're going to have more places to put things, but it's going to end up that we're going to have less sets. So it will wrap around sooner. It will actually be just as bad. We'll have more places to put things, so we'll have half the number of sets. But since we have half the number of sets, it needs to wrap around in half the time. So we'll store things in the same set after 1 kilobyte. Yes, we'll have 2 things we can store in each set if it's a 2-way cache, let's say. But we'll have 4 things to store in those 2 places, just like we have 2 things to store in the 1 place now. So we'll still run out with the set associated cache. It won't help. We just don't have enough space with the size of our cache blocks. Things would be different if I asked you, would making the cache block smaller help? And it would. But making the cache more associative won't. So this is an example of a case where how you write your C code matters. Where you can write C code which is good with caches and is bad. So we can make our C code worse by how we write it. And this is something we're going to think about more for the rest of the day. First, I'm going to go through an even trickier example, a sort of more pathological example. So here, I have an array here, which is 128 ints. So that's 512 bytes. And I'm just going to sum the first 2 values from an array of these structs. So how many cache misses am I going to have? So what's the maximum number of cache misses I could have? Anyone tell me, like with any cache, what's the maximum number of cache misses I could have? Like not this particular cache, but how bad could it possibly be? Yeah. Yeah, so we can miss every time we try to access items, and we do that 16 times. So we have between 0 and 16 misses. And there's an assumption I should have stated here, which is the cache starts empty, which I should have stated in every other case. So if we assume that, we have a certain number of misses we must have. And that's that we access item 0 and item for the first time. We can't possibly have any part of item 0 loaded in cache the first time, same with items 1 and so on, because they're so far apart. But A value and B value are probably in the same cache block. So we could save the miss when we access B value. So that's the question here, is basically, when we access item 0 B value, is that value in the cache? So anyone have an answer to that? So is it in the cache because we accessed A value? They're in the same block, so as long as we didn't have to evict that block, we're fine. So where could we have run into trouble? And have a miss. So the question here is, what cache set does this go to? So when I equals 0, let's say this starts at address 0, then this will map to set 0. Since our cache is 2k, it's also going to be the case that I equals 8, which is 2k kilobytes into the array, maps to set 0. Does that make sense? So it's 2 kilobytes into the array, and our cache is 2 kilobytes, so they're 2 kilobytes apart, so they map to the same set in this cache. And that means they both map to the same set. It's direct map, so there's only one thing which can go there. So that's going to be a cache miss. This next time we access item 0. So even though we're accessing the block twice, we evict the block to access items 8. Or 8. I did not mean 8, I meant 4. And items 4. Sorry. We evict the block to access items 4. Yes. So each of these struct item is half a kilobyte, and we have 4 of them. So that's 2 kilobytes of space. That's just before it. So this makes sense. So we have conflict misses here. These aren't capacity misses. We're only accessing 16 values, and our cache is 2 kilobytes. We have plenty of extra room. But they all happen to map to a very small number of sets. And we could have avoided this if we designed our C code differently. So we're going to talk about sort of principles behind doing that. Okay. So I'm going to go through an example where I'm going to use matrices. And the reason I'm going to talk about doing things with matrices is not because I really like linear algebra, but because this is one of the cases where optimizing for cache performance comes up the most in practice. Because they're dealing with lots of data, and you're doing calculations where you have to access values multiple times, it's one of the most natural cases where it matters. How are you using your cache? Are you actually getting effective use out of it? And we could use like 2D arrays in C to represent matrices, but I'm not going to do that. So there's two reasons for that. So one is that allocating 2D arrays of variable size in C is really, really awkward. So I don't want to do that. Another is that it's not entirely obvious what's next to each other in a 2D array in C. So I'm going to use something where it's very obvious how things are laid out. So instead of writing row ij, I'm going to write I times n, n is the amount of number of elements in a row, plus j. So any questions about the notation here? Hopefully, so we're going to use it a lot. So I'm going to use this little problem today and a bit on Thursday of matrix squaring. So this is a formula. We just do multiply elements of a matrix together and sum them up to get elements of a new matrix. So that's a formula, just tells you the math to do, and here's a very straightforward translation of it into a bunch of for loops. So we accumulate our results in each bij. I would assume it's probably initialized to zero somewhere. They're not showing. And we just add all of them up, and that does this calculation. This makes sense. So like I showed you before with our examples of summing up lists of things, there are multiple ways of writing this. So this is one way of writing that formula out as C code. One of the most straightforward. Here's another. So which do you think is better? So why don't you figure out which you think should work, perform better, and check with the neighbor to see if you agree on what should work better. And ideally have a reason why you think it should or shouldn't be better. And we're talking about cache, so we should think about locality. So anyone have a theory why one of these would be better than another? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Since you accessed the probability, doesn't it make sense to do one of the first
So what is better about the second one then?
It's the first one is better.
First one is better?
What, yeah, what? Because it's accessing it in verbage orders.
It being?
The IJ.
Which thing, so it's at, in row major.
Basically, it's accessing it row by row.
Okay, so I agree, it's so we're accessing the row, this is together, right? Yeah, okay. And the rows of this are together. So that looks better. And you're saying that, yeah, we have to do this, that's not really row major, but that's, you know, compared to the other stuff, it looks like it should be better. Okay, any other opinions? Or do I need to make the argument for the second loop? But there is an argument for it. There is a reason you can think it might be better. Okay, so I like the second loop better because we read this value over and over again, and rather than reading it once and not using it ever again for a long time. We have much better temporal locality there. I also like it better because we access this and as you said row major, we have to have good spatial locality in that. And we still have pretty good spatial locality here, even though the temporal locality isn't as good. So there are arguments to be made for either of these loops. So there are things which are good and bad about them as far as locality. So some types of locality are better, some are worse. And I would not ask you to figure out which does better because it's really hard to tell. So I wanted to figure that out, so I did the logical thing of actually running them. So with the K as the inner loop, the second version, or the first, as the first version, is that's the higher line, that's slower. K as the outer loop happens to be faster. So I plotted here the number of instructions. So they take the same number of instructions. I just swapped four loops. The number of instructions we run hasn't changed, but the number of cycles it took did because the cache performance changed. Yes? So you're saying, why do we have these spikes? We have a spike here. We also have some little spikes there. So you might think maybe you're horrible at measuring things. It turns out, no, I'm not. Those are real. So anyone have a guess for why we have those spikes? We'll get to that later if no one does. But yes, they are real. We'll explain what those are later. But they are real, and yes, there are spikes. But even ignoring those, our outer loop order does better. That's just what happened when I ran this on my desktop, carefully timed them for varying sizes. That's what the N is. So there's other ways of viewing this. So another thing we could look at is the number of cycles per instruction. Since I know I'm doing the same amount of work, it's just that sometimes the cache is slower. This is a helpful statistic to look at. It tells us sort of how cache friendly is it. And we can see that we're getting a lot more instructions done per unit time in another case. And another thing you might look at, which is very similar, is you might say, how many cycles are we taking per operation? Like, how efficiently are we doing the multiplying and adding, the real work? And this is a very common metric for evaluating problems like this. You just say, how, you know, all the accessing values in memory, that's just overhead. I want to know how fast does each multiply and add in effect. And so what this showed us is that, you know, we are the good loop order, the Kij order, had good spatial locality in Bij and Akj, and good temporal locality in Aik. And that just ended up, in total, those advantages in locality being better than our good spatial locality in Aik and our good temporal locality in Bij that the other version had. So it wasn't that either of them were really horrible, it's just that this type of locality happened to work out better than the other type. And in practice, when people want to figure out what to do, like they have a guess based on this sort of analysis of what locality is better, but they just run them both. Why wouldn't you? if it doesn't, it's not obvious, and you can just do it. Okay. So does that make sense? So this locality analysis. So this is our sort of, this is the high level things you look for, but usually when in a problem like this, it's not clear. If it was clear, you wouldn't need to run it, but it wasn't, so I did. So I showed you performance. So there's other ways of looking at what happens. And in fact, on modern machines, you can look more directly at what's going on when you run programs. So rather than counting just the amount of cycles it takes, we can actually count the number of read misses. Like there's a counter I can access which tells me how many cache misses were there. And this is different than the number of cycles because other things are going on in the processor. We'll talk more about that either Thursday or after the test. So this is not the same as the number of cycles, but this tells us more about what's going on in the cache. And you can see that there's a much more dramatic differences in the number of read misses here, some of which apparently just don't have as much of an effect on the number of cycles required for some reason. And we have this weird spiky stuff that I said I would get to. So let's take a closer look at that. So I'll just take a closer look at the beginning of this chart. And first we have this region where the number of misses is almost zero. And that stops at some point, a little less than 100. And what's special about that number? That's the about this where the matrix is large enough to fit in the L1 cache. So when it fits in the L1 cache, we have essentially no misses. That makes sense. I'm running this lots of times, so it gets to stay in the cache. When it's bigger, we start having misses. And we have misses typically at a basically fixed rate. But we have these weird spikes. Anyone notice anything about where those spikes occur? Seem random? So one of them doesn't seem random, and that's this one. So this spike is at n equals 128. So that's 2 to the 7. So did we just get lucky and we happen to randomly have bad performance at a power of 2? No. So what was our problem with powers of 2 before in caches? Yeah. Thrashing. So what does that mean?
It just dumps and then reloads the values like every single time it tries to access them.
Yeah, so we have value places where we're constantly replacing values because we have two things that go to the same set. So the problem with powers of 2 is that means we have the set index bits are the same because when you increment by a power of 2, we don't change many of the bits. And so things end up going to the same set, so we end up having a small number of values, or sorry, a large number of values in a small number of sets. So we run out of space, and we have extra misses. So that explains 128, right? So the set, we increment by 128 in our array, most of the set index bits stay the same, so we end up going to less sets, and we end up having all these extra misses. So what about these other values? Well, I've selected a few of them. It happens to be the case that we have this spike at, say, 93. And it happens that if you multiply 93 times 11, it's almost a power of 2. Not quite, but almost. And another one is at 114. If you multiply that times 9, it's almost a power of 2. And it's the same sort of thing is happening with these values, except it's not an exact power of 2. So if we look at, say, 114, when we add 114 to our address, so add 114 elements to our address, we advance to a different address and so on. And if you remember how I said my desktop caches work, we had 6 set index bits after 6 block offset bits. So let's highlight those. So because we're almost adding a power of 2, when we add 9 times 114, most of the set index bits stay the same. So we end up going back to the same set. So this means that we're storing more things in that set which means we have more conflictnesses. And this is an example of how, you know, you can get conflict misses being a problem even in cases where it doesn't seem like you're doing anything weird. Like, you don't need powers of two. Like, we're just using very innocent, non-related to our cache layout array sizes, it looks like, but it turns out we get into trouble. So that's what all those spikes are. So there are ways of avoiding that. We're probably not going to talk too much about that in this class for time reasons, but there are ways of avoiding those. But that's why you see that. And it comes up in a lot of problems where you're accessing large amounts of data. And it shows you why we're really skeptical of direct fat caches. Because this is with an 8-way set associative cache. You can imagine how bad this sort of problem would be with a direct map cache. Okay, so let's go back to looking at our loops here and try to reason about what's happening in this loop and we're gonna, with the cache. And we're going to do this with the goal of doing something better than just changing the order of the loops. We're going to do something that's even better for the cache. So here we can say, in this, we load a value aik once, and then we do this loop, is how we can think about it. And that's, if n is big enough, that's basically what's going to happen. We're going to load aik, we're going to miss on aik the first iteration of that innermost loop, and hit every other time. And if n is big enough, for all the other things, we're going to load them each time we go to the innermost loop. Because we access bij, then we don't access it again until n more iterations at least, or n squared iterations of loops. So we have lots of other things we access in between. And so we're going to have lots of misses. So conceptually, all our, at least temporal locality, is in the aik, and basically, what our cache is being used for is keeping aik. So we're loading aik, everything else we're loading once. And you notice I've rewritten things here, so I like say, let's just load aik, that's what's happening. And this is a better way of thinking about how cache performance works. So rather than like trying to reason about do things get replaced, we're gonna think about our programs as what am I gonna load into the cache here? We can't actually say load this value into the cache. Like, I wrote that down, but that's not something I can write in C. But what I can do is make sure I use those values frequently so they'll stay in the cache. And when I do cache optimizations, I'm going to choose what I want in the cache and compute accordingly. And as long as I'm using those values repeatedly and not using other things, those values are going to stay in the cache. And this way I can choose to make the most effective use of my cache. So this idea of how we think about caches makes sense. So we're choosing values that we want to stay in the cache. We can't actually say put this value in the cache, but we can make sure we only access values we've chosen and that they fit, and that we're not accessing other stuff that's going to make them go away out of the cache. So in this case, we're effectively choosing to put aik, that one value which we in the cache, and everything else we're not. So I'd like to put more stuff in the cache. I'd like to load more than aik and have it be reused. And to do that, I'm going to do a little transformation of our original loop. So we have our loop over k, and I just split up the loop into two pieces. So I have kk, which goes 0, 2, 4, 6, 8, and k goes from whatever kk is to kk plus 1. So I split up the loop over k into two loops. So hopefully you agree that this did nothing except add an extra variable. Everyone? So did nothing except add an extra variable. So I did this, so I'm gonna do a second step, which is the more confusing step, of moving the loop that takes kk into k, just moving it into the middle. So this is the exact same calculation for the same reason I could change the loop orders originally. So this doesn't change the calculation, but it might change how the cache is accessed. And what you can think of this as doing is that we're choosing that we're going to load two values into the cache. So instead of choosing to load one AIK, we're choosing to load AIK and AIK plus one by doing this, because we're accessing them repeatedly together. So now we're effectively getting twice as good use of the cache. Whereas previously we were caching AIK, and that's about it, except for things in the same block as, you know, as we were going through BIJ. Now we're accessing the same part. Now we're accessing two things over and over again. So this should get twice the efficiency. And so this is overall an improvement. So I'm going to expand out this loop. So this is the same thing. I just wrote out both iterations of the loop separately. So it's the same thing as I had here, just with both iterations of the loop written out rather than having a separate loop. So here we have temporal locality in BIJ now, which we didn't have before, because we accessed it twice, so it's a little better. We have more spatial locality in AIK. So even though we aren't accessing AIK as soon as we were before, we are accessing AIK and AIK plus one, so we have more spatial locality. And yes, we have a little worse locality in the AKJ terms, because we have more of them and we're accessing them half as often, but it's not very bad. Like, there's two values we're accessing instead of one, that still shouldn't be a problem. So basically, we've seemed to have improved, you know, our locality a lot. We're making use of more values at once. So we should actually see an improvement in performance. And I can measure this. So I can look at read misses. So the most direct measurement is how often do we miss in the cache. And if we do this new version, we get basically half the number of read misses. It's basically twice as efficient use of the cache. Yeah?
So if you go back to this, what's to prevent you from doing that again?
So what's to prevent us from doing this? What do you mean by again?
Well, I mean, like, so if we're allowed to do it twice, if we're allowed to loop and roll twice, why can't we do that?
So yeah, so why did I choose here? I chose two. Well, I could have chosen four, and that is absolutely correct. So there's some point where it's not going to work anymore. So one observation here is that I have more spatial locality in AIK, but a little less temporal locality. If we make the number two really, really big, I might have too little temporal locality. Like, eventually there's going to be too many of these values to fit in the cache. And then I shouldn't do it anymore. It'll be slower. Or at least no faster. But clearly for small numbers, it's good. So you mentioned like doing it with a bigger increment on k. There's another thing we could do besides a bigger increment on k, which is going to also help us. And that's that, why did I choose k? Like, I could have done the same transformation for, say, I. So here, I'm saying I'm going to load AI K to AI plus 1 K plus 1. And I'm going to work on and so on. So I'm having more value stay in my cache by doing this. And I'm going to load a, and I'm working here. If we expand this loop, I'm working with bij and bi plus 1j repeatedly. Okay. So I get the same sort of advantage where overall, I have more locality, though not every, things are a little worse, but most things are better. So if I look at the expanded version of this loop, I'm accessing each AKJ twice, where I wasn't before, because I have this loop over multiple eyes, so I have more temporal locality there than I didn't before, and I have about as much locality in everything else, or maybe a bit more. So I'm getting more work done for each thing I'm doing. So this makes sense. So it's the same concept as we did with K, we can do it with I, and there's other things where we're gonna get to use more. So we're not getting quite as much temporal locality, but everything here should fit in the cache, right? Even though we're accessing AK plus 1J after we access AK plus 0J, it's still probably going to be the case that they're both in the cache. There's plenty of room for that many values. So there's a general form of this where we want to not just do K and I, we want to do J too, because we can see the same sort of benefits in J. There will be values that will expose more reuse of. And we also want to do more than just two, we can do some bigger number. So we have this general form, which looks something like this. I haven't written real C code because otherwise it wouldn't fit on this slide. But the idea is the same. We basically turn our triply nested loop into a sextuply nested loop. And we choose an amount to go in I, J, and K. And the idea is that we're going to load a block, we're going to load big blocks of the things we're working on. That's what we're thinking of doing with this. We're going to have this big block of I times J, big I times big J, or big J times big K. That sort of size of the matrix is going to be in the cache for the entire innermost loops. That's our goal. So in order to make that happen, it needs to be the case that all that stuff could fit in the cache. So that's our restriction. That's how we're going to determine how big we can make that amount we do this transformation by. But when we do this, we get benefit proportional to how much we choose for each of these indices. And this overall is called cache blocking. So we're working on a whole block of data all at once. And our goal here is that we're exposing more and more locality in lots of things. Whereas when we started out, when we just did loop orders, we usually had something where we had really, really, really good locality and something where we had really pretty bad locality. Now we have pretty good locality in everything, but nothing where we're accessing only one value over and over again. So here, you know, we're accessing, in this case, you know, k, each value from b, we're accessing k times. There's I times j of them, so they all need to fit in the cache. And similarly, each value of k, aik, we're accessing j times, big J times, and there's I times k of them, they all need to fit in the cache. So that's the idea. So we're getting pretty good locality in everything rather than having really good locality in one thing. And the core way of thinking about these optimizations in general is that the way we knew to do this is that we wanted to plan what's in the cache. So the general procedure, if you have a different problem, is you think, what can I have in the cache at once? And let me make sure, whatever that is, I work on that all together. So here we have a bunch of data we want to work on in the cache all at once. We do that work, then we do the next bunch of data we want in the cache all at once. So that general pattern you can apply to many, many problems where you have a lot of data that doesn't all fit in the cache at the same time. And this will give you a lot better performance, assuming your sizes are big enough. So I probably should have actual illustration of that. So here's like impact on the read miss rate. So it's a lot better, except for some issues with conflict misses. which are pretty significant issues. You'll note that I'm not showing performance. We will get to that next time. So that's what I have for today. So first, an important logistical note. There is a test next week. There is also a homework due next week. I am aware that this is happening. I am aware that the homework is difficult. Please do not expect it to be extended. The test will probably have a lot of questions about pipelining because we spent a lot of time on pipelining. So you should expect that having finished the homework will probably be helpful on the test because it's pretty likely we're going to like ask about forwarding on the test. And if you know how you implemented forwarding, that might be helpful. But just giving that warning, since I know it comes up every time we do this, people are surprised that yes, we really are willing to have an assignment due before a test.